The EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network presents Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis. Each week, Joan Lewis brings you news from inside the Vatican and the Church around the world, as well as interviews and answers to your questions. Now, here's EWTN Rome Bureau Chief, Joan Lewis.
Welcome to a new edition of Vatican Insider. I'll get right to the news segment, but first want to tell you to stay tuned for the interview and part two of my conversation with Monsignor Philip Whitmore, rector of the VEC, V-E-C, the Venerable English College, the seminary in Rome that forms priests from England. It's truly venerable, as it has a history of well over 600 years. Now, some news highlights. Sunday, February 10th at the Angelus, Pope Francis drew attention to the plague of human trafficking, and he called on government leaders to confront the causes of the trade in human beings. Recalling the World Day of Prayer and Awareness Against Human Trafficking, which had taken place the previous Friday, and takes place on the feast of St. Josephine Bakita, the Holy Father said the motto for this year's observance, Together Against Human Trafficking, is an invitation to join forces to overcome this challenge. All of us, he said, can and must work together to denounce the cases of exploitation and slavery of men, women, and children. He said prayer is the force that sustains our common commitment to ending trafficking. He then led the crowd gathered in St. Peter's Square in a prayer to St. Josephine, who had herself suffered as a slave before her conversion to Christianity. The prayer was shown on the screens for those in the square. The scourge of human trafficking, by the way, is also the subject of Pope Francis's February prayer intention. Let us pray for a generous welcome to the victims of human trafficking, enforced prostitution, and violence. Monday, February 11th, was a holiday in the Vatican, as it marked the 90th anniversary of the establishment of Vatican City State with the signing of the 1929 Lateran Pacts. For the Church, February 11th is also the 161st anniversary of the apparition of Our Lady of Lourdes to St. Bernadette. And it's the 27th World Day of the Sick, established in May 1992 by St. John Paul II, a year after he learned that he had Parkinson's. February 11th was also, this year, the 6th anniversary of the announcement by Pope Benedict XVI that he would resign the papacy effective at the end of the month, February 28, 2013. He made the announcement at the 11th hour of the 11th day of this month. Tuesday, February 12th, Pope Francis spent the morning in a meeting with the Council for the Economy. Also on Tuesday, the Vatican announced that Pope Francis will visit the Italian city of Naples on June 21st to take part in a meeting on theology after Veritatis Gaudium in the Mediterranean context. He's scheduled to arrive around 9 a.m. and will be welcomed by Cardinal Crescenzio Seppe, Archbishop of Naples, Bishop Francesco Marino of Nola, and Father Arturo Sosa, Jesuit Superior General. Francis will address participants in the conference that's being hosted by the San Luigi section of the Pontifical Theological Faculty of Southern Italy. The Pope will return to the Vatican early in the afternoon. He previously visited Naples in March 2015. And Tuesday, February 12th, marked the 88th anniversary of the inauguration of Vatican Radio on Thursday, February 12th, 1931. Pope Pius XI transmitted the first radio message in Latin in the presence of Guglielmo Marconi, inventor of the radio and creator of Vatican Radio, and Father Giuseppe Gianfranceschi, Jesuit first director of the radio. Wednesday, February 13th, Pope Francis authorized the Congregation for the Causes of Saints to issue a decree attributing a miracle to the intercession of Blessed Cardinal John Henry Newman. The move clears the final hurdle in his cause for canonization. Cardinal John Henry Newman is close to becoming Britain's first new saint since St. John Ogilvie was canonized by Pope Paul VI in 1976. The last English saints, 40 martyrs of the Reformation, were canonized in 1970. Also Wednesday, Pope Francis told the faithful during his weekly general audience that prayer with God is a silent dialogue with love at its core, where there is no pretense. In his ongoing catechesis on the Our Father, Pope Francis told pilgrims gathered in the Paul VI hall that true prayer is made in the intimate depths of a heart visible only to God. It is a silent dialogue, he said, with love at its core. To look at God and to let oneself be looked at by God is to pray. Pope Francis noted that in the Our Father, there's the absence of the word I. Jesus, he explained, teaches us instead to pray, Your kingdom come, Your will be done. The second half of the prayer then moves from Your to Our. Give us our daily bread, forgive us our trespasses. This use of the plural, he added, shows that Christian prayer never asks bread for just one person, but always on behalf of others. There's no room for individualism in dialogue with God. Thursday, February 14, Pope Francis nominated a new Camerlengo. Irish-American Cardinal Kevin Joseph Farrell, prefect of the Dicastery for Laity, Family, and Life, and a former Bishop of Dallas. The responsibilities of Camerlengo include overseeing the preparations for a papal conclave and managing the administration of the Holy See in the period between a pope's death or renunciation and the election of a new pope. The office of Camerlengo of the Holy Roman Church, which is situated within the pontifical household, has been vacant since the death of Cardinal Jean-Louis Touraine last July. To take office, Farrell, 71, will take an oath before Pope Francis, who will give him a scepter, a symbol of the authority of the Camerlengo. The current scepter, covered in red velvet, dates to the papacy of Benedict XV. During an interregnum, paragraph 17 of Universi Dominici Gregis establishes that the Camerlengo of Holy Roman Church must officially ascertain the pope's death and must also place seals on the pope's study and bedroom, and later the entire papal apartment. Also Thursday, at the Rome headquarters of FAO, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, Pope Francis told the staff of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD, that God appreciates their work to eradicate poverty and hunger in rural areas of the world. 75% of the world's poor live in rural areas of developing countries. Pope Francis pointed out how paradoxical it is that a good part of the more than 820 million people who suffer hunger and malnutrition in the world live in rural areas, are dedicated to food production, and are farmers. Today's trend sees a slowdown in the reduction of extreme poverty and an increase in the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. Few have too much, and too many have too little. The Pope described what he called this perverse current of inequality as being disastrous for the future of humanity. In closing, the Pope urged IFAD staff to always look for a face, the faces of the people behind the case studies. It's important not to stay on the surface, he said, but to enter into reality, to see the faces. Also February 14, Pope Francis met participants in the plenary assembly of the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of Sacraments that is discussing the liturgical formation of the people of God. We know it is not enough to change the liturgical books to improve the quality of the liturgy, he said. Liturgy is not a do-it-yourself activity, but the epiphany of ecclesial communion. Hence, in prayers and gestures, the we resounds, not the I, the real community, not the individual subject. In the liturgical formation of the people of God, said the Holy Father, one must keep foremost in mind the irreplaceable role that liturgy plays in the church and for the church. Pastors and laity need to be taught to grasp its meaning and symbolic language, including art, song, and music in the service of the celebrated mystery. But things should not stop at that. There's also need for the ongoing formation of clergy and laity, especially those engaged in ministries at the service of the liturgy. Underlining his constant attention to welcoming migrants, on Friday, February 15th at 4 p.m., at the Fraternal Domus of Sacrofano near Rome, Pope Francis presided at the Eucharistic celebration that opened the Free From Fear meeting on the realities of welcoming and receiving migrants, organized by the Migrantes Foundation, Italian Caritas, and the Centro Astalli. Well, those are the news highlights, and stay right here for part two of my conversation with Monsignor Philip Whitmore, rector of the Venerable English College. Welcome to the Q&A, but there's time today for only a brief answer to the question, who are the Church Fathers? I mean, don't we call priest father? The Church Fathers were those eminent teachers and writers and influential theologians of the early Church, especially the first five centuries, though the last of the Western Fathers was Gregory the Great, who died in 604. Their writings and their lives had a profound impact throughout church history, dramatically influencing the definition and defense of the faith. They are usually divided into three groups: the Apostolic Fathers, the earliest fathers who lived in or near the time of the Apostles, up to the last half of the second century, the Apologists, whose writings defended the faith, and those of the so-called Golden Age of the 4th and 5th centuries, such as Ambrose and Basil from the Greek Church, and Jerome and Augustine of the Latin Church. The study of the Church Fathers is called Patristics or Patrology, the Latin word pater, which means father. The Catholic Encyclopedia lists 87 Fathers of the Church, 16 are also Doctors of the Church, and 66 are saints.
Trump administration rolls back the Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate.
U.S. bishops calling for the total elimination of nuclear weapons.
Pope Francis offers prayers for the victims of the California wildfires.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
Your link to news headlines Catholics count on at the top of the hour. Weekdays on EWTN Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Want to be more successful? Be humble. A study at Duke University found that successful people tend to exhibit more humility than less successful people in the same field. Being humble doesn't mean beating up on yourself or denying real gifts or talents. That's self-deprecation, which is neither a strength nor a virtue. Exercising true humility, in both the theological and psychological sense, means being willing to see that you don't have all the answers and you can learn a lot from listening to the people around you. Researchers found that humble people did a better job of adapting to new circumstances and soliciting support from others, both of which contributed to the increased success of more humble participants in the study. Jesus said that the meek will inherit the earth. Well, science and the Bible agree. Let humility be the secret of your success. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Just turned 31. Feel that I'm being called to the priesthood. And I've been attending daily mass and just finding that falling more in love with Jesus every day and finding more opportunities to, you know, make sacrifices for him of myself and just allow him to enter me more. You know, how do we fully surrender to God and to his will so that we can more clearly hear his calling?
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back to Vatican Insider. Here's Joan Lewis.
Welcome back to part two of my conversation with my special guest and friend, Monsignor Philip Whitmore, rector of the Venerable English College, the English Seminary in Rome, and as you heard last week, it's one of the oldest and most venerable institutions in the Eternal City. Monsignor Whitmore, rector since June 2013, is from the Archdiocese of Westminster, and before 2013 served in the Roman Curia, working first at the Congregation for Bishops and then at the Secretariat of State. He'll tell us more fascinating stories about the college, the young men studying here, the Historical Archives Project, and much more. Let's talk for just a minute about what you offer here at the college. I'm obviously familiar with the North American College, our seminary in Rome, and I know that there are many courses offered there on the NAC campus, and the students also go to the Gregorian Jesuit University and the Angelicum, the Dominican University. Is that true of your students here?
Yes, most of our students go to either the Gregorian University or the Angelicum. One difference between us and the NAC is that they come here for their philosophy as well, usually. So they're here for longer, because they do 2 years of philosophy, and they do that in English at the Angelicum University. And then when they move into theology, if possible, we like them to go to the Gregorian, which is where our students have been going ever since 1579, because it was there at that time. It's the same Gregory founded that university and founded our college. Pope Gregory the 13th.
I hadn't looked at those dates. You're absolutely right. The students at NAC are in Rome for 4 years. They are ordained, the seminarians, they're ordained deacons at the beginning of their fourth year. At the end of that year, they go home to their own diocese where they are then ordained priests. Is there a similarity in those years here at the Venerable English College?
Yes. Well, of course, they have the extra 2 years of philosophy before they start theology, which is where the American students begin. So for them, it's after about 5 years that they're ordained deacons. And then a lot of them will stay to do a license. And licenses sometimes take 2 years. They sometimes take 3 years. So some of them are priests already before they've finished.
Right.
Sometimes they finish their license and go back and are ordained priests at that point.
Right.
So it varies depending upon which license they've chosen and sometimes which studies they've done before. Because a lot of our students arrive here already having studied philosophy and theology and perhaps with degrees in those subjects. So that means they have a slightly different kind of journey once
sure.
they get here.
Do they come knowing Italian or do they study Italian in their first year here?
Well, occasionally you get someone who knows Italian, but they're very much the exception. Most of them have to learn Italian before they arrive. And because they spend their first 2 years studying in English, it doesn't really hit them until year three. So we have to put in quite a lot of effort at the end of year two. Sometimes we send them to do a summer placement in an Italian parish so that they really have full immersion in the language,
sure.
so that it's not too much of a shock to the system when they have to switch the language of instruction into theology.
Oh, no, that's a wonderful idea. Now, do they have, like, apostolates in Rome? Again, only because I know it. I know, like, some of the NAC seminarians will be guides at the Scavi in the Vatican or a guide to the Basilica. So are there similar apostolates, if you will, for your students here?
Certainly, yes. We ask them to do some sort of pastoral work each week, and we do have some who do guides of the Scavi. You probably know it takes a long time to qualify as a guide for the Scavi. It takes about a year, and it's like a very heavy course at the university, but it's really worth it because they end up knowing everything there is to know about those wonderful excavations. But we have people who work at the radio as well, the news desk for the Vatican.
Oh, okay.
And we have people who do some catechesis in local parishes, and we have people who help with the homeless. We have a soup run on Tuesday evenings among the homeless of the area, and they all look forward to it. They call it zuppa inglese because it's soup with the English
bread. Oh, that's great, and that's a dessert. Zuppa inglese.
Well, yes, it's their joke, not ours.
Oh, I know. Now, on your website, I did see that there are Sunday masses in your gorgeous chapel. Is that open to the public?
Certainly, yes. Members of the public are most welcome at our Sunday 10 a.m. Mass.
Oh, wonderful.
We're usually there, the whole community. Sometimes we might be away for a human formation weekend at our summer residence, or sometimes the students have weekends when they're free to travel around Italy. But we always have somebody celebrating the 10 a.m. Mass during the year, whether we're here or not.
Oh, tell me, because it's so beautiful, about your out-of-Rome summer home.
All the students in all the colleges until about 30, 40 years ago would stay in Rome for the whole year. They wouldn't go home. So it gets very hot in the city, as you know, during July and August, and the universities are closed. So all the colleges had somewhere where they would retire to for the summer months. Our present summer residence is one that we got in 1920. We had another one prior to that, which was a bit smaller, so it wasn't really up to their needs in 1920, and they bought this lovely place overlooking Lake Albano. But we've still got it. A lot of colleges have sold their summer residence, but we held on to ours, and
good.
it was a brave thing to do, and it's not always easy to make ends meet, but we're just about there. And a lot of pilgrims come during the year when we're not using it ourselves, so it's a place where people can come and stay. And a very beautiful place, as you say.
It is. Now, I want to talk about where we are, this amazing building, very old building in the heart of Rome. You have gardens. I've been to press conferences in a small garden area. I remember a friend who rented an apartment in a building administered by the college, and it had a swimming pool. You said you still have that, right?
Yes, there is a small swimming pool in our garden. The garden was given to us by Pope Gregory XIII because he visited very early on after founding the place in 1579. And at the time, we were renting that garden from a neighbor. And he saw it, and he decided that we should have it ourselves, so he bought it for us.
Oh, how lovely. No, if you could just picture yourself in the middle of this very ancient city, it's the last thing you'd expect to see is a garden area, and also, obviously, a postage stamp-size swimming pool. But hey, if you can stay healthy by swimming, then you've got to do it. Now, Monsignor Whitmore, as I walked in this afternoon, I walked by a table with various booklets, pamphlets, histories of the college, and I saw one, Unlocking a Hidden Heritage. And I thought, what's that about? And it's about your archives. And I'm going over. Tell us about your project for the archive.
Well, you know, we have archives that go right back to the very beginnings of the history that we've just been talking about, and even earlier. So we've got documents that go back to the 13th century and every century between then and now, recording the history of the English hospice and some of the pilgrims who used to come here, and then the early days of the seminary, the days of the martyrs, and the French invasion at the end of the 18th century, and then our restoration in 1818, which you mentioned. And then in the 19th century, we had a bit of history that would really interest you, which is that the first two 19th century rectors were asked by the Pope to be agents for the new dioceses in North America. So we've got lots of documents about the early history of the Diocese of Baltimore, the Diocese of Quebec, and I think you know something about Philadelphia.
Yes, exactly. Now, for example, this pamphlet says the highlights of your collection, as you've just mentioned, you know, the architectural records, obviously guest list, pilgrims list, the name of every single student since 1579, financial records, photographs, important individuals who've had, you know, some kind of correspondence, and then with the North American Agency Papers, that section is called. But now you need to upgrade archives. I mean, things today, we're talking digital, we're talking enormously different ways of preserving things. So what are the needs right now? What are you doing?
Well, we've got a wonderful professional historian who's working on our archives, and that's really taken us into the modern age, because prior to that, there were students looking after the archives in their spare time, and they don't have very much spare time.
No.
They had a bit more in the days when they stayed for the whole year, because they could do a lot of work on the archives during the summer months, but now they just go home in the summer months, so there was a period when the archives really were rather neglected. But we want to move beyond that, and
sure,
we want to make them available to scholars from all over the world, and we've discovered that there's a great demand, a great interest. So we've very recently set up a reading room where scholars can be received, and we're trying to develop the catalogue. We've got a kind of a rudimentary catalogue, which goes back to about the 18th century, but we're trying to amplify that up to modern standards, not only saying what we've got, but what the content of each document is, so that people who, if they're interested in the Diocese of Baltimore or are interested in John Henry Newman or whatever it might be, they can do a search on the computer and find out everything we've got that is related to their area of research. So that'll take a lot of time and quite a lot of money, but we want to move forward and do that.
Oh, but it's worthwhile, because, I mean, after a certain point, any archives you might have been in, or the Vatican Secret Archives, over time, things like paper will disintegrate. And I mean, they still might be 300, 400, 500 years old today. You have to go in, you have to wear gloves if you're going to touch or look at any of the documents. So obviously to have it digitized. And think about it. You're going to have history in your documents related to the college itself, to the city of Rome, the country of Italy, to the UK, to the Catholic Church and the Vatican. So an extraordinary encompassing field of documents and everything that you will have, or that you do have in the archive. One last question. Is there an alumni association that's active here in Rome? Do you have events every so often in Rome, and alumni priests come, you know, back for a reunion?
Yes, well, most of our alumni, of course, are in England and Wales, and they get together quite frequently. Our biggest annual celebration is what we call Martyrs' Day, when we commemorate all the college martyrs We do that on the 1st of December, because that was the anniversary of execution of our first martyr, St. Ralph Sherwin. And there are groups all over England that get together, our alumni, on that day, and they celebrate and they toast the college and pray to the martyrs.
Oh.
So that's one of the things that they do. But they also have annual general meetings, and every 2 years they come here to Rome for those, and then the other year they have the gathering back at home. So they're very active and very supportive, and they've certainly been able to sponsor quite a few of our modernization projects about the college.
Oh, thank God.
They're a great help to us.
Now, Monsignor, in this little bit of time, we've covered an awful lot of areas, and I hadn't even planned on talking about the archives till I saw this amazing brochure, so I thank you for that. But anything I may have overlooked you want to tell us about, or have we kind of done a good summary?
Well, perhaps one thing I should mention is that although we were founded for England and Wales, we do have one or two students from other parts of the world. In particular, recently, we've had a few Scandinavian students, and we're very pleased to have them. You know, the church in Scandinavia is really tiny, very, very small.
Exactly.
Small numbers. And so,
yet they have a cardinal.
They do now in Sweden. That's right.
Yes.
Well, we have one of his students, one Swedish student. We have three from Norway. And about 10 years ago, we had a couple from Denmark as well. And we're really pleased to have them. I mean, they have their own seminaries, but they're tiny. They've got about three or four people. So it's good for them to have their roots at home, but also to be plugged into the wider church and have contacts and have a sense of what the church is like in other places.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're a tremendous enrichment to us as well. We've also got some Maltese deacons. And I'm very pleased to have them too, because they speak wonderful English and wonderful Italian. And they share an awful lot with us in terms of culture.
Right.
So that's been great too, and it broadens the perspective. I'd like to get some Australians too.
Oh, that's true.
That would be good.
Of course. I'm here, as you heard me say earlier, with Monsignor Philip Whitmore. He's the rector of the Venerable English College, known just simply as the English College here in Rome for seminarians. And thank you for making that last addition. I had not realized at all. So a beautiful profile of an amazing, beautiful historic institution in Rome. And when I announce Monsignor as my guest on Vatican Insider, as I always do Friday on my blog, I will also post the website so people can see that link and visit the college at least at a distance. So thank you, Monsignor Whitmore. God bless.
Thank you, Joan.
Well, that's it for today, but please come back and join me again next week on Vatican Insider.